The following is a part of the Radio Memphis On Demand service. It originally aired live on Radio Memphis and has been edited for time.
I'm so sorry. I give in. God forgive me for all I've done. At your mercy.
There you have it. That is a brand new music for Radio Memphis and Radio Memphis around the world right here from none other than Mr. Rob Muschietti. The song is called Middleman. And I was telling you, look, he's coming out strong. He's coming out big. He's coming out with all of his stuff. He is constantly in the studio and he is making some fantastic things happen. And in fact, he is working with a very, really cool group. It is actually RNU Music Management. And of course, they're doing some amazing things with him. And then of course, you know, this all kind of works out with what we're getting ready to kind of get into. Those of you who understand RNU Management, if you guys remember not too long ago, because we're getting ready to jump into the Road Crew radio series, I actually had a nice sit down and talk with none other than Mr. Dan Stevenson. Well, Dan Stevenson is part of that team, as well as another gentleman by the name of Patrick McKenna, and they're going to be doing some fantastic stuff in artist development and artist management, so you want to kind of keep an eye out with those guys. But, you know, when we're talking about the Road Crew radio series, you know, Dan was part of the whole trip, you know, of course, brought to you by Kimbar Films. And we talk about these core group of people that were part of the Alice Cooper, you know, camp, if you will. And so this kind of led into, actually, believe it or not, the gentleman that we're getting ready to talk to today. So there's a connection there. We'll talk about that here in a few. But for those of you who've tuned in, of course, tuned in to Radio Memphis around the world, and we're in the middle of a Radio Memphis Road Crew Radio Alert. And that's actually part of the Radio Memphis Road Crew Radio series, again, brought to you by Kimbar Films. And what we're doing is that we're bringing a ton of insight to the table for emerging artists and our entertainers, and by sitting down with the pros from behind the scenes. Of course, you know, those guys that are in charge of those live shows, those guys that are in charge of that cool live event, those guys that are in charge of being in the studio and making those cool records happen. Yeah, we're getting with all of those guys, and we're sitting down and we're climbing into their mind, getting their stories, having some fun, getting the dirt, because we're all about some dirt, right? Well, for today, very special deal, because we're getting a phone call in all the way from Pennsylvania. We're going to be talking to a Michael T. Goodwin, okay? Here's a gentleman who's had over 30 years in the business, okay? He is definitely a visionary. He pretty much serves as a managing partner, as well as a director for Control Freak Systems, which is based out of Pennsylvania. And the company itself is pretty much interactive as far as with video controls. And what it does is that it creates custom control software solutions. And by providing clients with cutting-edge hardware and custom software solutions, what they'll do is they're able to fully integrate, you know, control of video, lighting, motion, live audio, you know, and things like that. And the cool thing about Control Freak Systems is that it pretty much is actually become a very, very niche company, okay? And its reputation is being built on being able to provide really cool solutions for things that have never been done and of course, never been seen, you know, and are very, very challenging, and everybody's really into that. Now, the background for Control Freak Systems is pretty much is the entertainment industry, as it is Mr. Michael T. Goodwin's, okay? Because, you know, it pretty much got started out through the music touring business, and then it expanded into corporate theater, product launches, you know, installation, as well as broadcast. Now, of course, you know, if you think about it, and you actually do a little research, you know, through that particular company, you know, working with the likes of Bon Jovi, Bruno Mars, Foo Fighters, Maroon 5, Tim McGraw, Soundgarden, Pharrell Williams, you're thinking Journey, Lady Gaga, Beck, Lionel Richie. Okay, these are some pretty cool names, you know, if you ask me. I think so. And with that being said, you know, they're able also to do, you know, to do some really some cool corporate gigs and actually be able to work with some cool companies and products, you know, do stuff for the NFL, done stuff for the NBA, they've done stuff for EA Sports, you know, they've actually worked on, you know, work on projects, you know, for Oculus, you know, Jaguar. They've even done broadcasts and presentations, you know, for Comedy Central, Nickelodeon, Universal, YouTube Music Awards, Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. You know, we can go on and on and on. But I want to, and this is what I'm wanting to do today with you guys, is that I'm wanting to sit down with Michael Goodwin because he also, you guys may not be aware, had spent a few tours of duty with the Alice Cooper camp, okay? And that was pretty much near the beginning of his career. And since then, obviously, he's done a lot. And I know that he's going to have a ton of stories. I know that we're going to have a ton of fun with him. So let me go ahead and bring him on in with us right now. How are you doing, Michael?
Hey, D, how are you?
I am fantastic, brother. How are you?
I'm good.
Good deal. I'm so glad that we had the opportunity to sit down and get with each other and have some fun and all that good stuff.
Yeah, it was good for me after the talk we had a couple of weeks ago to listen to my friends, the other guys who have done one of these interviews on Road Crew Radio, and it was great to listen to their stories and the other things that they did, and I learned a few things about my friends I didn't even know.
See,
which was interesting.
That's the beauty of it, and I tell everybody, it's so funny. I love that statement. I love it when you guys call me up or you send me a message and you go, and these are people you've known, you've spent a life with, you've been on the road with, and,
right.
And you're like, hey, I learned something about them. I'm like, ha ha, good, we're doing our job. Because today you're on the chopping block, brother. We got you today. And so,
yeah, okay, that's fine. I'm good with it.
And it's funny, and for those of you that have tuned in, I'm talking to Michael Goodwin. And I noticed, you know, some of the posts and stuff, you know, I was doing a couple of things on social media, and a lot of the guys started popping in. They're really excited that you're doing this today, you know.
What you mean, the other guys from those years, you mean?
Oh yes. You know,
yeah, cool.
We've got a little bit of Florida tuned in. We got a little bit of Nevada tuned in. You know, we got a little bit of Missouri tuned in. You know, we got a little bit of Maryland tuned in. We got the UK tuned in. So yeah, everybody's all thrilled to jerk.
Oh wow, well, baddies on, huh? Cool.
you figured that out.
Yeah, well, you know, unless somebody just happens to be over there, he would be the most usual suspect to be from the UK. So.
Absolutely. Well, I tell you, you know, and now that you kind of understand how this goes, and I know that you've been able to listen in, obviously one of the things, you know, Michael, that I wanted to do was pretty much sit down and talk about you and talk about your career. Now, you're doing amazing things now, and what's really funny is that there's a lot of people that get to tune in, fans, you know, musicians, artists, you know, and people in the industry, and they love to hear the stories, they love to hear how you got started, and they love to hear how you kind of jumped into some of this stuff, and just...
Well, you know, it's fundamentally just happenstance that, you know, kind of parallel opportunities that I didn't even realize were there when I got involved in it. It's sort of like, I always like to say, I was always in the wrong place at the right time.
Ah, good.
You know, I mean, I went to school for theater. I went to Lynchburg College,
okay.
Which is not to be confused with Jerry Falwell's college, Liberty College. It's in Lynchburg, Virginia.
Sure.
But I went there, studied theater, so I kind of had an intent, if you will, to begin with. But it wasn't to be in the music business or the touring business or anything. In fact, in those days, there really wasn't a touring business.
Right,
you know,
right.
Per se. The thing kind of grew up around me over the course of my life. It was small when I was small, and we got big together.
Wow.
So for me, when I got out of college, my first instinct was I wanted to go into legitimate theater, but I didn't. I was, you know, just a boy from Virginia. I didn't know anybody in New York.
Right.
And there had been some issues with... There had been some union issues and some stuff like that had kind of made that era, I think it was the 70s, kind of a weird place to be in New York for people in the theater trade.
Well, sir.
And so, you know, I when I got out of school, I really wanted to go to Arena Stage, but and work there. That was the closest thing to me from being in Lynchburg. But you know, they weren't going to pay me enough for me to be able to actually even service my student loan.
I got you.
So I got a gig really working in an office, and, you know, it was just based upon the fact that I had a college education, took the bus to work every day.
Wow.
And I worked for this company that put together colleges and universities that were looking for people to teach with people who wanted to teach in different positions.
And okay.
It was like a service, kind of. And I read the paper every day, looking for a gig, hoping I could find something relevant to what I knew how to do, which was nothing. All I'd done is really just go to college.
Well,
and there was an ad in the paper one day for a guy who knew something about lighting, and I'd studied lighting design in school, and to work for a band. And it turns out the band was Donald Byrd and the Blackbirds, which
wow.
is a jazz band.
Wow.
And they were based in D.C. And I was living there, so it kind of made sense. And I sent a resume off to Tony DiMattia, who was my first teacher and mentor in the business.
Okay.
And a few weeks went by, months went by maybe. I happened to be in Richmond, Virginia, on New Year's Eve, and I got a phone call, and it was Tony. And he said, we've looked your stuff over. We like you. Can you come to Boston by train, or I think it was by train, yeah, by train, and meet up with us in Paul's Mall, you know, in 2 or 3 days, whatever the time frame was.
Right.
And so I went home, went back to D.C., got on the train, went to Boston, packed a bag, met those guys, never met Tony before, you know, walked into Paul's Mall, and I started gigging with them, which was basically, I did everything. I drove the truck, you know,
wow.
I did drums, I took care of whatever had to be taken care of, and I was technically the lighting guy for the band as well.
Okay.
And sometimes that meant, you know, I was in some place like a VFW type hall with 5 rheostats on the wall, and I flashed them, turned them off and on, made them change color or whatever.
That's awesome.
And then from time to time, you know, from being with that band for a couple of years, we would do festivals, big festivals where we'd be on stage with like the Barcades, for instance.
Cool.
You know, and yeah. I got to know a few people doing those kind of things.
Absolutely.
And I got to see kind of what bigger shows were like. And one of the things that I really wanted to do when I was in theater was the idea of you know, I was fascinated by the road shows that came through my school.
Well, sure.
And I thought that it would be really cool to learn how to do all that stuff and to essentially take the idea of what the place where I'd learned to practice the craft, which is in a theater house, and make that portable and take it on the road.
Right.
And, you know, as the business progressed, that's exactly kind of what happened. So
that's cool because, yeah, and I tell you, Michael, what I'm learning about all of you guys, and you know, that have been doing this and are very, 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 very successful at doing this, is that the majority of you guys that are successful, you wound up having a very, very hardcore base as far as theater and theater background, you know, and during that time, you know, it's just like you said, you know, you're talking about the 70s and stuff and it being a real weird mm-hmm. place, you know, as far as, you know, things like that, you know, whatever the case may be. I mean, you guys wound up learning some very, very cool things through theater and brought it to rock and roll.
Right, exactly.
Wow.
And so, let's see, where was I at? I was, so I wound up in D.C. Working for a company called City Lights, Neil Flytel's company.
Oh, okay.
And part-time, when I wasn't on the road with the Blackbirds, we were basically weekend warriors. You know, we would go out on Wednesday or Thursday, come back Monday or Tuesday. We stored all the gear in a storage locker in Rockville, Maryland, and we drove 12-foot Ryder trucks all over the country, Tony and I. And working with City Lights, I got a lot more lighting experience doing local gigs with those guys. And one day, we had to go down and take a ground-supported lighting system to Raleigh, North Carolina, because the band that was playing there that night, which was Parliament Funkadelics,
nice.
Couldn't rig in the building. There were no rigging points in the building, so they sub-rented this gear from us. And I called up Tony, and I said, hey, you want to come do a lighting gig with me? And it was like 2 Ryder trucks, I think, full of lighting gear, and we drove down there, set all the stuff up, and during that day, the LD for Parliament Funkadelics was John Roth.
Oh, wow.
And the night before, when they were doing a loadout in Philadelphia, the electrician, Apple, had jumped off the back of the truck and broke his ankle, and they needed somebody.
Of course.
And John liked me, liked what I did, so, you know, there's your opportunity kind of thing. Liked all the paperwork, was impressed with the job that I did, and asked me if I would be interested in going on the road with him.
Mm.
So I sent Tony back with the truck. I don't know where we got another driver to drive the second truck, but he went back to D.C., and I got on the bus with those guys and stayed out on the road for maybe 2.5-3 months before we went back to Philly. And the company that was doing the tour was McManus Enterprises out of Philadelphia. Mm. And then I moved to Philly, and the rest is history, kind of.
The rest is history. Well, it's funny because, I mean, you know, through this whole thing that you just kind of went through, I mean, you literally went through the paper. You literally just threw it, just started hitting and throwing darts, and somebody called you up and said, hey, will you do this? And you're like, yeah, sure. Without meeting them, without figuring out who was who, and, you know, and met up with them, and then next thing you know, you're doing this, you're doing lighting, you're on the road, you know, and this is during a time period where it's not as sophisticated, obviously, as it is now, you know, and so you're having to make, you know, some really cool, you know, crazy cool magic happen. You know, did you really think that this is, you know, this is the route that you were going to take?
I don't know that I actually thought about it in those terms. My whole modus operandi was to try to learn as much as I possibly could.
Absolutely.
And so as I got more involved in this business that was developing, I took every opportunity I could to learn as many skills as possible.
Right.
You know, eventually I wound up doing absolutely everybody's job one time, which then turned me into the perfect candidate to be the person that I morphed into when I got a little bit older. Because you're turning to the production manager or the staging supervisor or whoever it is, and the more you know about everybody's job, the better.
Of course.
But, you know, it was a craft to me, and I wanted to perfect my craft, and I wanted to be good at it.
Mm.
So...
Never an inspiration to actually be the artist or you know, the musician and stuff, you know, that was on the stage performing?
No, not at all. I am a musician, actually, which really helped out a lot in terms of my timing as a lighting guy, especially early on, because I could read music, I understood music.
Right.
I played French horn when I was a kid.
Oh, funny.
And that turned into trumpet.
Yeah.
And I've been playing guitar my whole life. So it was easy for me in terms of being the lighting guy, who is sometimes looked at as an artist and because of what he does, from a design standpoint or from a timing standpoint, whatever.
Sure.
I was able to kind of, that part of my career especially, fit in. It was like a hand in a glove kind of thing. So I think being involved in music was something that benefited me, but it's certainly not something that in and of itself led me to want to do some of the physical crafts like rigging or audio. Or, well, audio is kind of music oriented as well, but scenic design, those kind of things. Those are all things that I learned from the course of watching other people do it and thinking it was cool and wanting to get involved in it, or thinking I could do it better, whichever the case might be.
Absolutely. And I tell you what, Michael, and for those of you that have tuned in, I'm talking to Michael T. Goodwin, and we're in the middle of a Radio Memphis Road Crew Radio Series Alert right here, brought to you by Ken Barr Films. You are the first one of everybody I've talked to, so you get this accolade. You're the first one that has made a statement stating that music helped you do your job.
Right.
You're the first one. You know, and being able to understand that, and you know, and I love that. That's something that I adore that. You know, because that made so much sense to me.
Well, but that could work against you too. You know, I mean, it's one thing that it's
man,
good to be
good
in a place where you enjoy what you're doing, but if the music's bad, then it's really hard to get your job done.
Well, hey, I didn't say it. You did.
Well, but that's when you rise above professional, and that's where you look at yourself as a professional.
Of course.
And you pride yourself on the fact that that's what you can do.
Of course. You know, and you're helped there, and you salvage it, and you make things, you make magic happen, and you work with it and stuff. And again, I'm gonna go on the side of the fence that the music thing helped you out, because regardless if it was bad, good, or indifferent, at least you were able to keep the beat.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's true. Especially when relevant to the whole lighting aspect of it and performance being tied in with the band. There's all kinds of amazing feelings that you have when you do those kind of things. You know,
Oh, yeah. When
you're tuned in with a band and you're running lights for them, and you after a while you get to the point where you feel like you're part of that whole unit, and you know where they're going. You can tell what their intentions are. I mean, there are some people like Bob Dylan who, once he gets to a certain point in every song, it's go fish. There's no telling what he's going to do next.
Of course.
Make the audience run away because he's the worst guitar player in the history of mankind.
Oh, my God. What?
I've seen people recoil from his solos when they start. It's absolutely
really?
Amazing.
Really?
But then again, you know, like when I worked with Springsteen and doing lights for him was quite a very tactile, encompassing kind of thing, because he's a very intense guy, and it looks to the outsider like he plays a different show all the time, but in fact there's really about four or five patterns that he will take, and within those patterns at certain points he will make predictable tributary kind of right turns or left turns. It's not really completely just made up as you go along.
I see. But you're
and learning
that.
All that kind of stuff is pretty heady, and being part of that, because you're performing, you're doing something for a couple of hours at a time. That's your showtime period.
Sure.
If you're the front of house audio mixer or the lighting guy, or even if you're just the dimmer guy backstage and you're waiting for the show to end so you can load it out and get out of there.
Right.
You know, it's a time period where everybody pays attention and your job is on the line, essentially.
Essentially, it is. I tell you, I love that little snippet, man. I don't know. I'm not gonna sit there and think about these things the same again after this.
Think about what thing?
Just the artists and stuff that you're talking about, whether or not the guitar solo was good or not. And
well, I mean, bad is bad, man. You know, an out-of-tune machine is an out-of-tune machine. And it's not like it's like that all the time, but it does happen from time.
No, I totally get it. I tell you what, though, because what I'm going to do is I need to stop down. I need to take a commercial break.
Yep.
We have set the stage. We've set the table because this is the part where we kind of bring you into some of the connections with some of the other guys that we've been talking to, and then we're going to get into some of the meat of the stories and things like that. So I don't want you to go anywhere, okay, sweetie? I'm going to play Shut the Hole for just a second.
You got it.
All righty. And for those of you that are tuned in, you're tuned in to Radio Memphis Around the World with me, D, right here at radio-memphis.com. We're in the middle of a Radio Memphis Road Crew radio series interview right here. And, of course, it is brought to you by Ken Barr Films. And, you know, we're having some fun. You guys, you don't want to go anywhere because I think right after this commercial break, I got to play one song for you. Actually, believe it or not, it's going to be a request from Mr. Eric Gales. But once we bring Mr. Michael T. Goodwin back in, I think we're going to get into some dirt. So, you guys, don't go anywhere. Only this is happening on Radio Memphis. That's Eric Gales for you by request right here on Radio Memphis Around the World. You tune in radio-memphis.com with me, D. Make it there. Why? Because you need to, and we believe you can. Those of you who know, he's out and about, and he is rocking the planet. He has come back strong. He is in the middle of his world tour schedule. His dates pick back up. Next Saturday, September the 9th, he's going to be in Las Vegas, Nevada at the Big Blues Bender. So those of you in Las Vegas, you have a chance to catch up with him on the 9th and 10th. If you happen to do it because you heard it right here, make sure you go up to that man and you tell him that D from Radio Memphis said hey, all right? And of course, now you go, those of you that are tuned in, we're in the middle of a Radio Memphis Road Crew radio series alert, you know, brought to you by Ken Barr Films. And we have Mr. Michael Goodwin on the phone with us right now. We've been chatting it up and having a good time. How you doing, honey?
Hey, good. How are you? You sound okay here with the new phone?
Yeah, absolutely. We sound fantastic. And of course, those of you who tuned in.
Okay, great.
Yeah, they don't realize that we did a total switcheroo, switch phones, switch deals, called each other on cell phones and made this happen.
That's Murphy's Law. That's the whole thing. What you do when everything just goes to shit. You know, you got to stay calm and just get through it.
Look, I'm gonna tell you how special you are to me, Michael. I had a flat tire coming into the studio, okay? and luckily, because I know my family is tuned in, I fondly refer to them as the Asian invasion. The Asian invasion is here, and of course, I called them from the highway, and it was, come get me and take me to the studio because I've got some cool things happening, and then you guys deal with this. And let me tell you what, as we are doing this interview, everything is wonderful, everything is perfect. I now have a tire on my truck. I got a brand new Coca-Cola that's cold waiting on me, and I got you on the phone. So this is a good day. This is a fantastic day. This was meant to happen.
Yeah, I hear you.
So back to Road Crew Radio stuff that we're talking about. And we kind of, you know, those of you who've tuned in, you know, of course, in the beginning of this interview stuff, we kind of got a little bit of background, a little bit of, you know, insight on how you pretty much got directed into this thing. So, you know, you wind up really doing some cool stuff. You wind up doing some successful, you know, routes, and you come back to, you know, Philly or whatever, and you're like, okay, now what? You know, what do I do now? You know, and how does this work? So when you come back from these, you know, from these events and stuff, and what do you decide to do from this point? You know, are you looking for gigs? Is somebody calling you and signing you in on some stuff, or how does this work?
Well, it's the first couple of years like that, maybe the first 5 or 6 years, I'd say it was. In those days, I would go out for a long period of time. You know, like when I did the 79 Kiss Dynasty Tour. That was 18 months, maybe 20.
Wow.
And during that time period, you might work for 3 or 4 months straight, doing 4 or 5 shows a week.
Okay.
And then you'd be off for 2 or 3 weeks or whatever. There'd be a leg where you jump from North America to Europe, and that might naturally take 10 days to happen. You'd have a little downtime.
Okay.
But generally, when you're done with something like that, you don't want to do anything right away. You know, you want to go home and rest. Sometimes it'll take you a week or two to get over that kind of, you know, extended deep space mission.
Yeah.
I worked for McManus out of the P-Funk thing, and there were connections in there, and their management saw things in me and wanted me to go in different directions, and I just basically took what they offered.
Okay.
And then parlayed that into whatever other opportunities presented themselves as it went along. I didn't have a serious course plotted out to go to a certain place. You know,
I
like I said on our pre-interview, I've never really had a job.
Right.
You know,
that's awesome.
I've just done this from, you know, day forever. So.
I got you. So I'm curious, you know, because I was looking at some of the posts here on the Radio Memphis mm-hmm. Around the World page, and of course, you know, Dancer, I know he's tuned in, and I see that he's jumped in on a couple things, and of course, wanting to remind you of a couple stories, and of course, you know, of course, Batty's jumped in on a couple of things. How is it that you showed up with Dan and all of these guys? How did you show up into this?
You know, that was like 88, 89. This was after I'd gotten back from living in Australia and my first divorce was done.
Oh, wow.
With filming myself in O'Hara in Chicago on January 2nd with, you know, my halberd full of clothes, set of golf clubs, and $300. And I sort of started to rebuild my life from there.
Oh, June.
Somewhere in the next year and a half or so in that time period, give or take a year, is when I hooked up with Dan. And I'd been doing some shows with someone that he knew, Kieran Healy, who was a lighting designer in those days. I think he went on to fame and fortune with The Voice. I think that was one of his products.
Okay.
As he got older. And Dan, I think Kieran had designed Julio's show, and Dan was the production manager for that.
Right.
And I had forgotten about this, and I had to call him the other night to ask him about how all that happened.
Oh,
and then
nice.
So Kieran sent me out to meet Dan, see if I was going to be compatible to go on the road with him to do lights for Julio, which was his design. And Dan and I started a friendship that's gone on now for however many years that is.
Right.
90, you know, 30 some odd, 25, 30 years.
Wow. So you come in.
And that was another situation where you walk into a situation. I think we went to production rehearsals in Jersey for a short time period, and then our first gig was 3 or 4 nights at Radio City. That started a tour, and that was very therapeutic and healing for me, because, you know, it's like I told Dan, he said, well, what do you need from me? And I said, I want to make sure nobody knows I'm here. I need to hide out for a couple of years and build my bank back up and kind of recover. And we went from that into Alice Cooper. And I think we did a couple of tours with Cooper, and there were some other things that I did in the midst of all that. I don't know that the timing was all completely one thing into another, but that started that relationship with him. And,
Oh my goodness!
And we worked together a lot. We worked together in the '90s doing car shows, corporate theater, and those kind of things.
I got you.
Dan and I haven't done a gig together in, I don't know, maybe 10 years or more.
Maybe it's time.
He remains a close friend and someone that I got to know well from the Julio Alice days.
I see. So you show up and you tell him that you need to hide out and you need to, you know, rebuild yourself. So you're being treated, you know, like, you know, like witness protection program, you know, in the touring world, which is, I guess can happen, you know.
Well, in those days, it could happen. It without cell phones and social media. You know, nowadays, it wouldn't be like that at all. And in some ways, a whole parts of my life would have been completely different had we had the communication level that we have today, because one of the famous things about people who get involved in theater, aside from the fact that we're all kind of damaged to begin with, it seems, is that, you know, relationships go to hell because of the amount of time and focus that we spend doing our craft, honing
right,
our craft, and also,
right,
especially like in those years, the amount of time that you were gone. So nowadays, you can stay in touch pretty much on a 24/7 level, so it must make it much better for relationships with people who travel.
Makes it much better or makes it worse for a relationship? Let's be honest here.
Yeah, I guess so.
I mean, come on. let's think about it for a second. I'm sorry, I'm real jaded when it comes to this, and you know,
yeah.
You know, I'm one of those that I don't understand.
I'm picking up on that.
Well, you know, I'm trying to draw some junk out of you, brother. So I figured, all right, you're not going to show me cards. Let me show you mine. This is how I feel about this. You know, I'm thinking if you've got to check in, you know, and if I've got to tell you how many times I peed that day, and if I've got to tell you, you know, what my stuff looks like.
Yeah, that's like the Twitter level type stuff. Yeah, exactly.
I hear you. I kid and I tease and stuff like that. But I mean, I guess I'm real intrigued. That, you know, and again, I didn't realize maybe that I was associating it with the time period now, and you actually put it in really cool perspective for me, that, you know, hiding out while you're on tour. And I was like, can that happen? That's awesome. I was like, I would so do this. I would go hide and go work and tour the world while hiding. I mean, that's a sweet gig.
Exactly.
That is a sweet gig. So you go in, and of course, and one of the other things too that I've noticed, there's some crazy reason why all the guys that wound up getting together, and I think about Dan, and I think about Batty, and I think about Ken Barr, you know, and I think about, you know, all the people I'm getting to talk to, you know, everybody wound up doing other things and kind of spawning off and, you know, going in and and was all said and done. Some of you, you know, were able to, you know, make some incredible companies and, you know, incredible, you know, things happen for yourself and roll on with. But this time period with Alice Cooper was very integral for all of you. And everybody has a different reason, you know, as to what the impact was or what it did for you or what it did for your career. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, how did that affect you?
Well, that time period, aside from what I was saying about the personal thing that I did during those years, it was, you know, for me, more of the craft, more of doing those kind of good things. And I'm a military brat. I was born in, on an Air Force base in Japan in the 50s.
Oh, okay.
And my brother was born in France when we were stationed in France. And so I'm kind of used to traveling. I like traveling and I like going around the world. And
right.
Those years especially were fantastic for the places that we went. We went all over the globe.
Wow.
And I think it affected me in that way, the way that contributed to my life was I got to go to all kind of places on somebody else's dime. And a lot of them are vacation places that I didn't spend my own money to go to because they weren't nearly as great as they seemed to be.
Right.
And it was also just great international travel, you know, which is, let's face it, if you like traveling, that's something you want to do. You want to see all kinds of weird places.
Of course you do.
And the stories and the relationships with the people, too. I mean, you know, Ken Barr said it best in his interview when he talked about you're out there with family because you have to watch each other's back.
Yes.
Especially when you're in completely foreign places where they, you know, they don't speak your language and it's hard enough to communicate by, you know, chicken and cow making noises to get food.
Or you could be like Batty and just, you know, go and place bets with the Frenchman and whether or not, you know, your family member's going to make it across the road. You know?
Yeah.
I'm just making sure. And speaking, you know, family members, and speaking of traveling, and speaking of Japan, what's this thing with Dancer talking about? Don't forget our golf in Japan.
Oh yeah, he and I were golf buddies. So we went to a couple of high end clubs in I think we were over there in August too, which is a complete suicide to play golf in, you know, on those months in Asia because it's 120 degrees and it's 140% humidity.
Of course.
We went to the this 500 club, which is a super high end place. They make you stop at the turn after 9 and take lunch, which you want to do because you need to cool off, and then you take a bath when it's over and then a hot spring kind of thing. It was, you know, really, really good times.
Yeah, so you're not going to tell me.
Tell you what.
I don't know.
I'm pretty innocent, really.
I know.
That's what he's talking about.
You're giving me innocence.
He's in Taiwan, too. The same thing.
I got you.
Super, super hot. And female caddies that wear the long dresses and the pointed hats.
Oh.
And long sleeves. It's hilarious.
So you guys, I mean, it wasn't even about playing golf.
Yeah, it was. Well, it was about drinking, too, I think, in those days.
Okay. just kidding. I'm yanking on your chain, Michael. That's all I'm doing. I mean, out of experiences though, when you guys are doing this and you've got all of this fun and you've got all this excitement, you know, what's the craziest time? What's the craziest time that you can remember having and having to do your job at the same time?
There were scenes with Julio in Spain that were just outrageous. It kind of made me understand the mindset of somebody like Salvador Dali, who's Spanish as well. And
sure,
you see these things that are just so monumentally bizarre. These Plaza de Toros with 25,000 or 30,000 people in it, and Spanish culture is more at nighttime. It's in the middle of the night, and the kind of scenes that you would see are things that you can't create in any other way. You've never seen anything like that before. There was a show that we did in Torre Quebrada that was outdoor, the ocean is in the background, and it's nighttime, so you have that whole scene there. And it was a revolving stage. Julio played on one side of it.
Wow.
And then when the thing turned, it was some Spanish acts on the other side of it, and there were like 100 flamingo dancers dancing all in tune, and it's 2:30, 3 o'clock in the morning. You know, it's just really bizarre, colorful, unique kinds of things that you don't get to see, unless you go there.
Unless you go there. And, of course, it's normal to them, and you're like, okay, I'm just going to kind of join in, and I'm just going to, you know, whatever, and make that kind of stuff happen. Now, and as far as your experiences when you're doing this and you go to these different cultures and stuff, did you have a thing, you know, did you have a thing about you, like, you know, I'm going to make sure I learn some language, or I'm going to make sure that I'm going to, you know, eat some of their food, or I'm going to make sure that I'm going
to
do.
What I used to do when I went to Asia was especially Japan, I would just, the minute because you're so screwed up jet lag wise, when you get there, you have no idea who's on first. And I would just go walking through the neighborhood. Sometimes I'd go with somebody else, but you're just Guy Jing hunkering down through the streets of, Osaka or someplace, and you dip into a local place, and it's big, it's a closet. There's enough room in there for like 5 or 6 stools at a sushi bar, and you walk in, everybody looks at you, you look at them. Nobody knows what to say. You sit down, you know, you buy your first beer, and you don't buy another drink the rest of the night because you're all, everybody's speaking different languages, trying to get to know each other. I enjoy that kind of thing.
Okay, and you try to figure it all out when it's all said and done.
Yeah, I mean, I did the same thing in Spain when I first got there. I thought the place sucked, and I couldn't find anybody. You know, nobody does laundry in August or anything in Spain anyway. Most of Europe is shut down.
Wow.
But it wasn't until one night when I couldn't sleep, and I went out at 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock in the morning to walk around a little bit, and that I realized that that's where the culture and the society was. And after that, I understood it, and I fit in with it better. And, you know, it's not unusual to get a midnight 1 a.m. reservation for dinner because it's cooler, and people tend to live at night.
Of course. Of course, and that's the way it works out for them. And so, you know, and you being able to kind of insert yourself here and there and wherever and figure that out, absolutely. And I guess, you know, and for those of you who have tuned in, I'm talking to Michael Goodwin, you know, for part of the Radio Memphis Road Crew Radio Series. What would be the thing, you know, I mean, obviously we're going to kind of get into what you're doing now and what you're getting into now. You wind up, you know, with all of these really cool experiences, and the entire time, I mean, you knew this was for life. You knew that this was what you were going to be doing forever, you know. And did you ever find yourself where you just fell just completely in love with what you had got going on?
Oh yeah, I mean that's the baseline for the whole thing. Even the idea of wanting to be able to perfect a craft and being able to say things like I said not long ago, which is I've never really had a job because I've sort of, you know, this is the lifestyle and everything that I chose and the profession that I chose. And being able to do it on a constant level is, and a consistent level so that you can support yourself,
right,
is gratifying. And as you get further into it, it becomes more and more gratifying.
I got you.
But, the people that you meet and the things that you do, because you're in these circumstances of traveling and doing unique things, you know, taking chances that other people might not take, which is some reward that goes back with that, I think. But at the same time, putting yourself in situations that are not just basically get up, go to work at your office, come back, be at home and you're doing something unique and interesting all the time in different places. It's there's a lot of commonality to it.
Sure.
And it does get to be rote after a while, but it's always a little bit different.
I got you.
That's the thing I love about it, I think.
Well, and I guess the funny thing is, too, another thing that kind of intrigues me is, you know, ultimately how you got started, you know, and of course, you know, we talk about, you know, with their theater background and you're not necessarily, you know, having to figure things out. And it's not like you had all of the tools and you know, all the bells and whistles then. To, let's fast forward, you know, to kind of what you do now. And after all, you know, after all this time, you know, and all of this experience, you know, and after all of, you know, all of this, you know, trials and tribulations, you know, you are working with a company and a part of a company that are making some really cool stuff happen, you know, and in a million years, I mean, you're on the forefront, Control Freak Systems is on the forefront of making a lot of, you know, a lot of magic happen, you know, and did you think you would wind up being able to take, you know, take this craft as far as you had?
I didn't see where it was going, if that's what you mean. I mean, there's been time to time, the watershed moments when you realize things are happening, like when I first saw MTV.
Yeah.
I realized that was going to be the end of touring, even though I technically went, started, you know, toured from 88 to 92, 93, I think it was, which was well after MTV, so it's still out there, but
of course
that was a different kind of a choice, you know. So right. and then when the internet stuff started, it completely blew the market out from underneath all the HBO type television, big MTV shows that I did in the 90s.
Wow.
So that was a place to change gears, you know, and go in a different direction, like, because you saw things that were happening. But I wouldn't have imagined that I'm doing what I'm doing now, and what I'm doing now only really in the sense of kind of like seasoning or business acumen or knowing how to keep things together is really how I'm in with this company. It's a business manager for the company, and the intellectual property of the company really rests with Stuart White, one of my partners, and the other guys in the company that make it all go. They're the geniuses that figure out all the software. I just manage the world around them so that they can work in those conditions and keep, you know, progressing themselves within their own realm and progressing the company as well.
Nice.
Most of the stuff that they do, I don't have the technical skills to do.
Wow.
Which is hilarious sometimes.
What you understand, though, I mean, but you understand, and it's funny because there's so much effort, you know, and think about it. You just made a statement, you know, MTV comes out, right? And, you know, you're thinking the touring's
right.
over and touring's done and stuff like that. What is the biggest emphasis right now that everybody's doing your own company is a part of all of these things. You know, you guys,
right.
your company, and everybody's all about, you know, trying to put on this fantastic show and trying to put on this fantastic presentation and trying to fake. Because why? Because that's where money is at these days. You know, it's not in record sales.
Yeah.
It's not in everything else. You know, it's everybody's, you know, we're kind of back to, hey, we need a show, you know. And when you,
yeah, well, you know, it's the immersive element or the ability to be immersed into something today that makes the thing attractive to the millennial generation, and we overuse that word extensively, but just to the general population.
I know
people don't want to just watch something; they want to be part of it in some way, whatever that might be. And so, virtual reality and those kinds of Oculus type events that, which I don't know if you've tried any of that kind of stuff, but it's you can get vertigo from it very quickly.
Yes, you and can. Yes,
making
you
the
can.
Thing that happens, whatever it is, whether it's a movie or whether it's a live concert, making yourself be in the middle of that when it's happening is really the next thing, I think. And all the technologies that are out there are missing the target in terms of hitting that sweet spot. They're mm-hmm. close, but mm-hmm. nothing comprehensively is put it together yet to make that the ultimate thing. And then you want to transfer that into the next thing that's happening with actual events themselves, which is, you know, rather than have 47,000 people in Yankee Stadium and have to sell 47,000 tickets,
right?
If you can sell 47,000 tickets multiple times by having a camera from that point of view, then you can, you know, increase your yield for every event that you have.
Of
and
course.
Some combination of those things is really the next thing that will be amazing whenever it all comes together.
When it does. And, you know, there's been... I have noticed, you know, some of the trial runs, and you know what I'm talking about, that everybody's, you know, kind of done over, especially over this past year with a couple of the festivals, that have been kind of going on, and it's one of those, hey, you know, if you guys want to check in, you know, and then they'll have that virtual reality moment, you know, of course, if you have this wristband, mm-hmm. you can get in, and that way, you know, it's good so they can kind of track, you know, ultimately what was going to, you know, kind of going on. And so mm-hmm. for those of you that have been doing this and the behind the scenes and working all this stuff, as if you guys, you know, already don't do a lot as it is, you know what I mean? And you're already figuring these things out. Now you have to think, you know, three-dimensionally, you know, and expound on top of that, you know, and, you know, yeah. what does that do for all of you guys, you know, when you have to think in that space?
There's always the war between commerce and art that's going on that drives the engine of that thing. And so, you know, a lot of those things are, I was just about to say, some of them aren't necessarily interconnected, but ultimately they all wind up being kind of interconnected. You know, the audio signal drives whatever kind of audience participation thing that's going on your phone. That kind of stuff is already happening, and it for people who are, I guess, if you're in the live, if everybody has their own little segment, you know, if you're in the live event business, right. The producers who are putting it on have a different bend on it than the performers that are on the stage versus the people that are in the audience, right. And the development of that kind of interactive technology, I don't know that it always displaces us guys that are in there making it happen. It gets a little frustrating sometimes trying to put it all together.
I think, sure. On
a few of those events that I've been in, there's just so many moving parts.
Right.
But at the same time, expertise then becomes a marketable skill, which is kind of makes it keeps you employed at the same time.
Of course, so. It keeps the world go around and, you know, and all that good stuff. Yeah, and it does. It absolutely does. Well, I tell you, you know, looking at the resume, you know, as far as through the company per se, you guys have worked with some amazing artists and some amazing people, and you know, just out of curiosity, through your career, you know, there's got to be a favorite artist. There's got to be. I mean, we know who can't play a guitar solo, but I need to. There's got to be somebody that you ultimately have just completely fallen in love with.
Well, you know what? I knew you were going to ask that. I've actually been ruminating on that off and on a little bit, and. I was telling somebody else this a couple of weeks ago, asked a similar question. It's so subjective, and it's conditional based upon what you know when you know it.
Right.
And the more you go on in your career, your ideas of what that might be change as well.
Well, sure.
But, you know, for me, oddly enough, and I picked on Dylan as a guitar player, but the Shot of Love tour that I did with him, and I think it was 1983 or 84, as a lighting designer, is one of my absolute most favorite gigs that I ever did. And just because of Al Cooper was a piano player and Bob was in the band, and it was, the music was pretty good, but the show was amazing, and I just felt great about it. And then there were other things that I did, like we filmed Bowie's Spider from Mars tour, and augmented, and we were in Australia for a couple of weeks, like 6 weeks, shooting various cities, and that were all edited together.
Well, sure.
And working with somebody like that was a real great, special experience. Okay. Super pro that David Bowie was.
Wow. That's amazing stuff. That right there. And see,
but, you know, one of my favorite years was the year that I did Steve Lawrence and Edie Grenier, followed by Twisted Sister.
Oh, now see, that's cool. That's a crazy.
I mean, that's
a crazy
kind of
trend. That's a,
stuff
yeah.
That and I kind of worked for them. I think at the same time, often on the way the schedules worked out. So, you know, I'd do a couple months with Twisted Sister, and then I'd go do 2 or 3 weeks with Steve Lawrence and Edie Grenier at, you know, Circling Around or whatever, wherever that was in New York City. Wow. And the dichotomy of that sometimes is shocking.
Hmm.
But again, then you fall back on being, you know, trying to have a professional attitude.
You're funny, Michael, because you keep coming back with that the professional attitude. Okay, I'm going to do this, and so just, you know, this is your mindset. You know, this is what you're going to do. You're going to have to draw in. Did you find that was tested a lot?
Oh yeah, I mean, especially when we talk about the good and the bad music stuff, and I won't mention any names in this particular case, but you know, when you're working with somebody and you have to memorize their music, whether it's for a 4-minute corporate gig or whether it's for a 6-week tour that you do with them, and you know, they come to you, they're looking for professional line design, they want someone to operate the show for them. You're obligated to learn all the music perfectly and do the best job you can, you know, making it as the nicest product it can possibly be.
Right.
Even though you go home, you go to your hotel room at night and you're like, you want to kill yourself because you can't get that music out of your head or that jingle out of your head. So, yeah, sometimes it's like that, exactly.
Is there ever a jingle, and when I say the word jingle, there has to be one that pops in your head and you're like, damn it.
Well, no, I wouldn't call it a jingle, but like one of the things we used to do with Coop stuff, you know, was we used to pretend that it was Alice Cooper doing Vegas show style, kind of lounge style.
Yes.
I've done that with Dan. Me and Batty have done that for sure, where we make fun of Coop. We're not really making fun of Coop, but we're just, you know, we're so ingrained in the music. And we imagine what it would sound like if you were a crooning, you know, singer in Vegas.
Of course. And all you're doing is just changing a couple things up, man, and just kind of lightening up the situation because everything has been going on
it's
and on
all
and on.
Timing.
Yeah, exactly. No, that's some good stuff. That's some very good stuff. Out of curiosity, so, and I ask this, you know, from everybody at some point, you got a young kid. It could be a guy, could be a girl, for that matter, that comes up to you and they're like, hey, I want to get into this business. I want to do what you do. What are you going to tell them?
Well, that does happen. And, you know, it's happened at different times. And the answer kind of, for me, is almost always the same thing, which is, you know, now that I think about it just in terms of advice, maybe, it would be to find something you want to do that you love. And you just want to try to learn everybody's job. That's one thing, too.
Right.
But something that really you're really comfortable doing or feel like you're going to be comfortable doing, and try it out. And, you know, just if nothing else, you could intern at a company. It would sort of depend upon the person's age, I guess. But, you know, easy to get along with the people and maybe start there.
Good answer. Very good answer. So you'd be the encouraging. You know, some of the guys are like, run.
Yeah, well, yeah, I hear you. But, you know, I've seen people flame out, too. I had a couple of people that wanted to try stuff, and they couldn't adapt to the culture. They couldn't adapt to the travel in some cases, or they maybe didn't have the skill set. So, you know, there's a certain amount of luck involved, but, you know, the more you, it's just like golf, the more you practice, the luckier you get.
Of course. And a lot of people don't realize, you know, the lifestyle that comes with this, you know, and it is a lifestyle, you know, and it's one of those things where there's no, you know, as you said it even earlier, you know, it's not the, you know, necessarily the, you know, the 8-to-5, you know, that everybody is so conditioned into thinking about, you know, and this is, you know, gig to gig, you know, this is moment to moment, you know, this is, you know, opportunity to opportunity. And, you know, your job is, you know, to make the world go around, you know, when these moments, you know, come across, and that can be at any time. And, you know,
it's a full commitment. I mean, it's not unusual to, you know, the whole thing about not getting a lot of sleep sometimes factors into it. You know, you'll wind up, especially if you're doing more, I don't know, touring's quite so much as special projects and TV shows, those kind of things. I mean, you could work 36 hours, 40 hours straight.
Right.
And then just sleep for a short time period and have to do it again. Not everybody can adapt to that. I mean, there's all kinds of different stressors like that. So, I think somebody who wanted to try to get involved with something, I'd want to know what their proclivity is or their preference. You know, you like lighting, you like audio, you want to build sets, whatever it might be, and then find a company that does that and you know, try to get a gig there, basically.
basically. And that's what you need
to
do.
I've been very creative with my resume much earlier in my life. You try to do everything you can to make every single thing that you've done sound like the most important show in the history of the planet, you know? So...
Love it. I absolutely love it. I had nothing,
you know. All I, like when I got out of college, I had to make it sound like every show that I was on was, you know, a big deal show. I
mean, of course.
I couldn't just put on a piece of paper, hey, I really haven't done anything.
Nope. Haven't been there, haven't done that. You know, these guys rocked all five blocks that we were on. You get what I'm saying? Right.
Yeah. But, you know, everybody has a different entry point, you know, and especially listening to some of the other guys that I toured with talk on this radio thing, you know, I realized that everybody has a little different style how they went about doing it.
They did, and I think that's the romance, you know, for this. And mm-hmm. for me, you know, getting to talk with everybody, you know, I support artists, obviously. I play their music, you know, and I think one of the coolest things on the planet is when somebody can create something from nothing, you know, nothing, and it's, you know, and it's finished and it's a completed song, and that, you know, and somebody ultimately is either touched by it, you know, whether it's, you know, through their heart, you know, through feelings, you know, whatever, you know. And at the same, now that being said, you know, these things that also happen with production, and these things that happen with these, you know, live events and these shows, and people that have, you know, things that happen in recording studios, you know, that's an art in and of itself. And there's so many times, you know, and we all come from a time when liner notes was like really, really, really important. You know what I mean? And, you know, it was one of those things where that was like that stamp of approval, you know, that was certified, that, you know, when you showed up on liner notes and you showed up in certain places, you know, that you were part of that program, or you were part of that project, or you were part of that thought, you know, and you helped make that magic, you know, to present. And, you know, and you think about it, you know, for me, you know, for those individuals that get to go and rock out and have a fantastic time somewhere, you know, there's an individual that's running front of the house, that's running stuff back of the house, that's running stuff, you know, behind the curtain or whatever, that's making this moment just that much more intriguing, you know, and magical for those that are consuming it, you know. And so, you know, your jobs also lie in making sure that music or that event or that product is branded correctly, you know. And that's, you know, that's a thing for me, you know. I know this. And of course, don't get me wrong, y'all got some really cool dirt stories. I know half of them do not come out on air, and I'm okay with that, but, you know, it would be kind of cool if it did. But, yeah, I mean, you guys wind up doing, you know, so much, and it's one of those things where this is, you know, this is not an easy thing, you know? A lot of people need to understand that, too. It's not.
Yeah, you know, and in terms of talking to people who may want to get jobs in the business for whatever reason, motivation has a lot to do with it, and there's a lot of pretenders in the business. You know, there's a lot of people who really don't have skill sets. There's
right. Got
to be. It's the same in any kind of industry, though. You know, but the more I talk to other people, now that I'm a little bit more involved in the business side of things, the more I talk to people, no matter what kind of business they're in, they all have the same kind of complaints that I do. There's systemic things, I think. That humans do, and it's not always tied into, you know, show business particularly.
Particularly, and you are correct in that. You know, there is something, you know, for everybody intently involved. You know, again, reeling it back in, you know, to you know what we have handed on the table. You know, there's so many people that take. And one of my favorite things, I think, is you know, at the end at the back cover of Kenny's book, Ken Barr's book, you know, We Are the Road Crew. One of the things it says is that, you know, people go to this, you know, this concert, this event, you know, and a lot of people don't realize that there's this crew that comes with this. You know, it's like you show up,
this
magic happens, and you're like, and it's that artist, and it's woohoo, and everybody's...
Well, it's not just the audience either, you know. A couple of years into working with McManus, I was Barry Manilow's lighting designer on the road with him. We were doing a load-in at the Greek Theater, which was, I don't know if it is now still, but in those days, it's like an outdoor shed, you know what I mean, one of those kind of places. And it's 9:30, 10 o'clock in the morning, I guess, and at that particular time of the day, any show that's setting up pretty much looks like an airplane crashed in there, and there's trucks everywhere and motors and chain and all kinds of crap.
Wow.
Some chains are in the air, some aren't. And I'm standing downstage talking to the TV lighting designer that was going to be filming the thing that night. And I look up, and here comes Big Bird, you know, Barry, walking through around the cable, jumps over one of the trucks, and walks up to me and goes, "What are you doing?" I said, "Well, we're loading in right now." He goes, "You mean all this stuff goes in every day you do a show?"
Yeah.
And I said, "Yeah. That's why it's the same every night, no matter where you are. We carry all this stuff with it. And when we tear it down, take it apart, and put it in trucks, and bring it to the next place."
Yeah.
He didn't even really fully understand that. And my mouth just hit the floor, but he was like, "Wow, that's amazing. Cool, man. See you later." And he takes off, goes to do whatever it was he was going to be doing.
Sure.
So it's not just the audience members that don't realize what goes into doing stuff.
Well, there, my point, you know what I mean? And then I said,
exactly.
It's one of those things where, you know, I like to pay attention to this kind of stuff, one, but also two, there's an opportunity for those that may not be a singer or may not know how to play a guitar or, you know, may not, you know, be suited, you know, for that world, but they want to be able to plug in. You know, and they want to be able to be part of, you know, part of this industry, or they want to be part of, you know, the entertainment industry. It's not just music.
Right.
You know, and these are like these are core things that, you know, that people can get involved with. And they are very important things.
Well, the hangers-on are always there in any kind of business.
Of course.
You have a certain amount of those. There's people who are in the business I know that are technicians that, you know, what they really want to do is brag about who they're working for and talk about their airline status. That's, you know, kind of like the main forefront of why they're doing it.
Oh, of course.
And it's to me, it's bizarre because it's hard. Doing this work is hard. The reward you get out of it is the work that you do.
Yes. And see, at least you said it. You know, it is. It is hard. You know, but then there's the majority ones I've been talking to where it's like everybody is just totally in love with what they did and what they're doing, you know, and this was what was really cool about that, you know, so
well, yeah. You know, and this group of people that you've mined into here, all of the core group of those guys, everybody is exactly like that, you know, we are what we do and have always been, and I think that's why we all worked really well together, we all traveled well together, and, you know, we had totally amazing time.
Yeah, and it was a very important time too, and that's the good thing. Out of curiosity, what's on the forefront for you? What's on the map for you right now? You got anything that you're jumping into?
It's the company, this control freak company that I'm you know, kind of managing now. We've grown every year now for the last 6 or 7 years, and we want to just make it bigger. And do more of what we're doing. And it's sometimes terrifying because you have to stay on the edge of that thing that we were just describing before, which is technology development, and
right.
You're not really sure where that's going. And there's plenty of people out there who are doing things that are kind of amazing who have much huger bankrolls than we do. But, you know, we just keep plugging along.
Good deal. Very good deal. You guys have any big shows or any tours or any concerts and stuff coming up that you're being involved with yet?
Not that I can talk about.
All right.
But,
okay.
You know, this time of year starts to slow down for us. We've got a couple of corporate gigs between now and the end of the year. And we're out with several tours right now. And, and they're continuing on. So, you know, it's actually become a lot more of the kind of job that I described earlier, where mostly I'm going to the office every day and coming home at night.
Right.
And then I just go in the field. I'm getting ready to go in the field next week to Boston to go to, we're doing something for the NFL kickoff, which is September 7th.
I got you.
In that park in the middle of Boston.
How cool.
And I'm going to go do some traveling there, but that's it for a while, actually, for me.
I got you. Well, we'll definitely be keeping up with some of that. You know, Michael, I want to thank you for spending some time with me today. You know, and of course, it's Labor Day weekend, and, you know, and I'm hanging out in the studio and having fun and playing music as well. You know, I appreciate you sharing your story with everybody. You know?
Yeah, sure. I'm happy to do it. It's been a very interesting thing, especially listening to all the other guys talk and kind of getting my head around, you know, stories from the old days.
Well, it's funny because everybody I've talked to, these stories from the old days has really affected everybody too. You know, it's made everybody go back into this really weird and crazy place, you know, in their head, and they're like, oh my God, I forgot about that, or oh my gosh, I didn't know that, or you know, and it's oh man, and you know, and it's actually kind of very, it's a very cool moment for me to kind of sit outside and look in and watch. So we got more of this coming. We've got some cool stuff coming. Of course, you know, we do the road tips on Monday nights, you know, for road crew and stuff like that. You know, we've also got, you know,
what is that? I saw that Tim Taylor had done one of them.
That's
different from this thing.
It is. There's several different things. In fact, well, since you're on here, I might even get to schedule you in one. What it is that it's a weekly road tip, you know, that happens every Monday night with me at 9:30 p.m. Central Standard Time. And it is, you know, it's just, you know, we get to catch up with one of the guys, and you guys have a tip that you want to give, whether it's a tip for being in the studio, it's a tip for being out on the road, or a tip, you know, for the stage, or whatever that you may want to give, you know, for road crew, or even for bands, you know, for that matter. Just one tip, and you kind of give a reason why, and expound on it for a minute. You know, Batty's, you know, had called in and done one. You know, we've got, of course, you know, Ken Barr has done one. We had Ken Kaler, you know, he's called in and done one. Of course, I've got here, you know, I'm supposed to get with him because I had to reschedule him, but you know, Putter is going to be doing one here shortly.
I can't wait to hear Putter's tip. That'll be monumental. That should be on the cover of the New York Times, or whatever that tip is.
Right.
He's one of the most amazingly conversant intellects I've ever met. His way with words is just unbelievable.
Everybody has some type of affinity and affection and connection with this man, and and everything has been just so crazy and off the wall and off the chart, apparently, you know, with him. Putter is going to be he'll be coming back in to you know, do a deal. And anybody else, so whenever I can get you to schedule in and you want to do one on a Monday night, you know, it's about 10-20 minutes, you know, a bit.
When you talk to Putter, ask him what he did with the forklift that only had one fork.
Okay. I'm gonna write this down. Hold on. What happened?
It's the crazy crap that we run into on the road. You know, there was some place we were loading out, and the forklift, the promoters showed up with a forklift, and it only had one fork on it. Didn't have the other side. You know, a forklift has two things.
It's like, what the hell am I supposed to do with this?
Yeah, and that's those kind of things where you're just like, well, at least it's not raining. You know.
All right, so
and then it starts raining.
Well, okay, well then Putter's got something to explain to me. I'll save that for when he calls in for the tip and stuff like that, and I'll get him to explain it to me. Perfect, absolutely perfect. But yeah, we've got the road tip, and of course, I've been making drops and making hints and things like that. And this may also interest you, sweetheart, is that there is a moment that's going to be coming up here soon. You know, probably, you know, in the next month, where there's going to be a show that is dedicated, you know, to the Radio Memphis, you know, Roku Radio series. It's actually called Radio Memphis Load In, and I'm officially throwing this out. So I mean, see, you're so special for me, you know. I don't know what happened today, but I'm gonna freely give information out, you know, as we speak right here. But we are developing an opportunity for once a month where it's a radio show dedicated, you know, to the guys, you know, as far as in the crew, and you know, guys behind the scenes, guys that are engineers and everything else, to where it's a live show. We may have, you know, 1, 2, 3, you know, 4 of you guys all call in all at the same time, and we all have a round table discussion, talk dirt, talk gossip, talk fun, talk industry, talk, you know, why does that forklift only have one fork on it, Putter? You know, it could be anything. And so that's also coming up too, and that's going to be kind of a check-in that everybody has once a month.
Well,
know?
One of the things that road guys excel at is telling road stories, so you'll have plenty of fodder for that.
I'm so thrilled. I'm so excited, you know, because again,
I've often walked up to a group of guys and said, you know, come on, can we get some work today? It's enough with the road stories. Everybody wants to tell them.
Of course. You can't help it. But hopefully we'll get you in on some of this stuff, and you know, and see if we can't throw you.
So it's going to be that same group of guys, all of us from those tours.
I'm sorry.
It's going to be that same group of guys, you know, Dan, Batty, Dancer, those guys.
To begin with, yeah, absolutely. And like I said, and as time goes on, you know, you never know. But yeah, for that first. personally, my thing is that I think for that first go is that I need that core group like to all show up on the phone at like the same time, or you know, at least two or three of you together at one time, and just because.
Yeah, I'm down with that.
Just because, you know, and again, you guys have had some things in the back of your mind. You have a question in your mind. You may have thought about it, not necessarily going to bring it up. And then we'll just have Putter ask the question out loud that we all were thinking. And, you know, everybody will start talking. And then we'll go into we'll go in from that. And who knows where it'll go. We're going to have a lot of fun with this is what we're going to do.
Yeah, sounds good.
Yeah, good deal. Well, listen, baby, I want you to enjoy your Labor Day weekend. Okay, and you know, you and I we'll get on the phone with each other and we'll talk and we'll chit chat and we'll see what else I can kind of get you in on. But in the meantime,
anytime, my pleasure.
I appreciate you so much, honey. We'll talk soon. Okay.
You have a great Labor Day weekend too.
All right, baby. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Bye bye. Bye bye. All right, that was Michael T. Goodwin right here on Radio Memphis. Guys, you have been tuned into Radio Memphis around the world, and he was part of the Radio Memphis Road Crew radio series. Of course, it's brought to you by Ken Barr Films. You know, we are the road crew. Remember the book and everything else. Yeah, right. Make sure that you guys go check out ken-barr.com and go stop on his website and stuff like that and see some of the cool things that he's kind of getting into. And if you happen to do it because you heard it here, tell him that D said hey. And in the meantime, you guys know every time you see Radio Memphis Road Crew Radio Alert, that means that we're talking to a professional behind the scenes and all of that. And we've got some cool, you know, we've got some cool interviews. We've got some cool infos. We've got some cool tips, you know, and all kinds of crazy stuff like that. So you guys, you don't want to go anywhere. You know, and when you see that, make sure that you tap in on it. And speaking of those interviews, you guys, you know, we've been kind of, you know, dancing around some of the stuff, you know, today during the interview. Next week, all right, September 9th, Dancer McCullough, he's up next, okay? All you boys that are tuned in from the road crew, yes, that's it. Dancer is up next, and I know you guys cannot wait for him to preach his gospel, all right? Good deal.
The proceeding was produced by Pirate Radio Studios Incorporated and originally aired live on Radio Memphis. Any offers or advertisement contained may not still be valid. All rights are reserved, and copyright is held by Pirate Radio Studios Incorporated, Memphis, Tennessee. For more, look for all the RMOD players at radio-memphis.com.